I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Joshua Wright. He dropped out of high school to become an activist when he was 14 years old. He's a forest defender based out of Washington State and has just released his film Eden's Last Chance, which documents his journey into radical environmentalism. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. Second, thank you for being on the program.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So why don't we start by talking about the film itself, and then later we'll talk about how you became an activist, because I think it's really important too. So tell us about the film itself. What's it about?
So Eden's Last Chance is essentially my journey of radicalization. It started when I was 15 years old, and I lived abroad with my parents who worked at the embassy. And I dropped out of high school in ninth grade, and this was right around the time when the IPCC was warning that we had 12 years left to avoid catastrophic climate change. And I kind of felt like nobody around me was doing anything. So I dropped out and wanted to make a film about climate change. And in the beginning, it started out as a project focused sort of on what you would expect for a film about climate change, you know, trying to stop a massive coal mine, which has gone in Australia, called the Adani Carmichael coal mine. But through that journey of filming Eden's Last Chance, it went from a film about how we're going to have to stop, you know, fossil fuels and transform our way of life and, you know, create renewable energy, to a film about, wait a minute, no, our entire way of life is the issue. And the solutions aren't going to be renewables. They're going to be a lot more radical than that. So it's a journey of my own radicalization, because in the beginning, I really did not know where it was going. And where it ended up going was kind of an indictment of our entire civilization, I think.
You know, this really reminds me of a line that has been very important to me that was said by my friend John Osborne when I was a baby activist. He said, so many environmentalists begin by wanting to protect a specific piece of ground, and they end up questioning the foundations of Western civilization.
Yeah, I think that's what's happened with me. I think in the beginning, like, I've always loved the environment. I've always, you know, when I was a kid, I loved the environment so much I wanted to go live in the woods and, you know, pick berries and just live kind of as a hunter gatherer. And I think as you grow up, you're kind of taught that, you know, we need to be realistic. You know, technology has done amazing things for the world and will continue to do amazing things for the world. And we need to embrace it, and we need to accept that the solutions are going to be technological. But, you know, we're at a point now, and we explore this in the film, where green energy is becoming one of the biggest threats to the environment. And there's the part of you that came into environmentalism to try and save the natural world suddenly sees that the environmental movement is largely focused on things that are destroying the natural world. And when you face that, I think a lot of people don't want to think about its implications, because, you know, essentially the implications of the fact that our entire civilization, you know, renewable energy or not, is still destroying the world. When you realize that, you kind of have to say, okay, well, then what do we do? And a lot of people don't want to make that decision, and also don't think that we possibly can make that decision, because this is what we've been doing for hundreds of years, and it's hard to imagine anything differently. But the fact is, humanity has been living without industrial amounts of electricity and without industrial production for almost our entire existence. So right now we're in the aberration, but we're cultured into a worldview that says, no, accept it. You know, technology just moves forward. Progress is, you know, progress will keep on going no matter what. And while that has been true for the past 100 years, couple, you know, even more than that, 500 years, I think we're running out of that being true. And I think another thing that we look into in the film is how environmentalism generally, you know, the message around climate change is, if we don't act, bad things are going to happen. But what we need to realize is that bad things have been happening for a really long time. It's just that, you know, those of us in the West have been the beneficiaries of the bad things. So we've been, I mean, for 500 years, colonization has been, you know, destroying indigenous communities. And beyond that, for well over 500 years, like thousands of years, 10,000 years, we've been destroying the natural world on every continent except Antarctica. And that's come in the way of civilizations, Western and non-Western civilizations. It's come in the way of agriculture. And you know, one of the main takeaways for the film, in my opinion, is realizing that, you know, there isn't some future climate apocalypse. The apocalypse has already arrived for the non-human residents of this world, who are the majority of life on Earth. And as environmentalists, we too often focus on impacts to humanity, which are no doubt important, but we view ourselves as the lords and possessors of nature and as having dominion over life on Earth. And that worldview has destroyed life on Earth and has destroyed indigenous communities across the planet. And, you know, I think that is what needs to change, not our sources of electricity and our ability to recycle, you know, water bottles.
So thank you for saying all that. I completely agree, of course. And it's can you talk more specifically about, so one of the primary reasons, if not the primary reason, I do these interviews is to try to help more and more people get off their behinds and actually do something to protect something they love, you know, whether it's a place or a species, or in some cases, you know, long form thinking is really important to me. So in any case, there's the big distinction always seems to be between those of us who go, gosh, things are bad, somebody should do something, and those who actually do it. And oh, a couple more things. One is that I know someone who used to be in the British military, and he said that there's a phrase they have for the people who actually, you know, as with most situations, there's only a few people who get most of the work done. And in the British military, they call them PLFs, which is persistent little, and you can guess what the last word is. And what PLFs do is a FGID, which is, you can guess what the first word is, get it done. And so how did you become a PLF? And what I want is, you know, it's like, so how, you know, we all know that there's something wrong. We all have those fantasies. I'll tell one more little story here and then go back to you, that you told the story of, you know, wanting to live in the mountains when you're a kid. I read the book when I was a kid, My Side of the Mountain, which is about a little boy who runs mm-hmm. off to the wilderness. And that was, I actually ran away because of that movie. It was actually a very funny story. I ran away, wrote the note and everything, and left the note out for my family. And then my disappearing note. And then I walked past the basketball court in the driveway, and I thought, well, I'm going to play one last game of basketball before I go. And I started shooting baskets and forgot about running off into the wilderness, and unfortunately forgot to pick up the note. So the family had great laughs over that one. Anyway, the point is that we I think a lot of us have those impulses as kids, but then, as you said, they all get, you know, I'm an environmentalist because somebody put in a subdivision next to where I lived when I was a kid, and I was terrible. That where will the meadowlarks go? So how did you get, what was the difference? What was it that made you actually do something as opposed to, like most of us, just going, gosh, things are bad, somebody should do something, which is where I should have just left the question in the first place.
Well, yeah. So I think that when I was younger, I probably spent like five or six years as a kid not doing anything, but really wanting to. And I saw that, like, I live in Washington State, and every year they would clear cut more and more of the forest behind my house. Overseas, I would see, I'd see animals, you know, getting killed. I'd see things that just, you know, make your stomach turn, and you're just like, you really want to do something, and you really want to take action, but you're almost, it's almost so serious that you just freeze. And you're just like, I couldn't do anything. I couldn't possibly do anything. And that's one of the things I hear a lot in activism. And it annoys me, but at the same time, I was this way too, where it's like, there's going to be a timber sale or something, and people are just like, there's nothing we can do. There's, you know, it's too late. There's nothing we can do about it. You know, we just have to accept that we're powerless and move on. But that's the exact, like, that's the issue. That's the exact thing that the powers that be take advantage of, is people's feeling of powerlessness and the fear of actually standing up and doing something. So when I was a kid, one of the, I think, pivotal moments for me was, like, I was at, my parents lived in Thailand, so we were in Thailand, and we were at, like, this market, and they were selling living crabs that had been captured from the ocean. And I, as a, you know, a new environmentalist, knew that, you know, the oceans are dying, and hated to see those crabs get boiled alive. And I had a moment where I was walking by them, and I saw that they were these crabs, and they were all tied up and ready to be eaten, and they're still alive, as crabs are when, you know, they're captured. And it was too terrible for me to do anything about it in that moment. And I kind of walked by, and then I kind of realized that this isn't about me, essentially, is what I realized. And I turned around, and I spent all my money buying crabs and putting them back in the ocean. And I think that was a really key moment, not because it changed the world, not because, you know, it's going to stop somehow save the oceans, but it probably mattered to those crabs, you know. And it's the shift from seeing yourself as a bystander and to seeing yourself as an active participant in what's happening to the world. So, you know, as part of a culture that is essentially committing ecocide against the natural world, we are all complicit in that unless we're actively resisting it. And that's not to make anybody feel ashamed or feel bad, because we're born into this. It's not our fault. And yet we are all complicit in essentially a genocide. And one of the things that sort of is looked at in the film is the idea of the bystander effect. And the way I describe it in the film is, you know, after the Rwandan genocide, researchers wanted to know how basically the majority of the population who weren't supportive of the genocide kind of let a small minority commit mass murder. And that's, you know, I'm not a sociologist, but I could imagine that that's, you know, how the process goes in most genocides. It's like, I don't think most people want it in Germany wanted to kill Jews, for instance. And the reason that those sorts of acts of, you know, insane acts happen is because people feel themselves powerless and just are bystanders and don't intervene. And I think the biggest difference between, you know, being an activist and just sort of feeling nihilistic and feeling like there's nothing you can do is realizing that you have agency, and whatever you do, it's going to be better than you not doing anything. So even if you don't win, you trying will at least push the needle a little bit. And we might not save the world, but we'll save, you know, you'll save a meadow or you'll save a forest. I mean, the real moment where I became an activist was similar to the, you know, when I saved those crabs, was actually pretty shortly after I interviewed you, when I ended up in an old growth forest that was set to be cut down. And my dad and I had kind of gone there thinking we'd be exploring it and just, you know, checking out this old growth forest. And there we were, and they had logging equipment there, and they were going to cut it down. So we started a petition, and we didn't save the whole old growth forest, but we did save about 19 acres of it. And I'm sure those 19 acres would rather that somebody's doing something to save them than not, you know what I mean? So it's taking action in whatever way you can and realizing that you actually have agency in saving the planet, because we're finding ourselves in a position where whatever we do is probably not going to be enough, because we are, like, I started the film when there was supposedly 12 years. Now there's 7 years. And, you know, whatever you think of the IPCC deadlines or whatever, we are still participating in, even if you're ignoring the climate crisis, it's an ecological collapse of life on Earth, one of the biggest ecological collapses in history. And whatever we can do to help shift that towards having more life and more ecosystems surviving, like, that's what we need to be doing.
So thank you for all that. I think that that's really important. I think that's, frankly, five of the most important minutes of any interview I've ever done. And And I want to go back to one of the things you said and see if you can reflect on it a little bit more, which is, that 19 acres is glad that somebody stepped up for them. And I think about that all the time, that if I were the forest where I live, it's like, what would I want to have happen? Who would, or if I were some sort of songbird living in some forest, what would I want humans to do? Or if I were a coho salmon, what would I want people who live on the Klamath to do? And can you talk a little bit more about that? Putting yourself in the position of being that being who within our system has no power and no voice, and how you empathize. Do you see where I'm going at with this, Joshua?
Yeah, I think I know what you mean.
Yeah, so go ahead and just take over.
Well, I think that our society has come around on racism and sexism. Like, we agree that those, not universally, but more and more, we agree that those ideologies are abhorrent, and we're trying to level the playing field and not be racist and not be sexist. And one of the things that our society takes for granted is the notion of human supremacy. In fact, if you even look up human supremacism, you won't find articles talking about how we think we're better than other species. You'll find articles about how we are better than other species. So that's the one of the like I think that that's one of the underlying assumptions of our culture, is that a human life is infinitely more important than a squirrel's life, or any life, slime mold's life, or lichen's life, or any other species. And to me, there's never been a difference. Like, we might be technically smarter in terms of computers or destroying the planet. We're pretty good at that. But since when did we care more about people? Or since when did we give more value to somebody who's smart than somebody who's stupid? Like, since when was that a good thing to do, right? And I'm not saying that animals are stupid, but they said that they have a different intelligence to us. We're very mechanical, we're very mechanistic, and they have been living sustainably in their environments forever. And I think that if you look at who's actually smarter, I would say that the squirrels are smarter than we are, because we are destroying the earth on which we live. And of any species, we've had the most deleterious impact on our fellow earthlings as any. And to me, I've always found that I'm not in environmentalism to save humanity. And I think a lot of environmentalists are, not because they're malicious, but because that's the only thing that they know. I'm an environmentalist because when you're in a forest, and when you're in a forest, it's going to get cut down. You feel the responsibility to do something about it. Or, it doesn't have to be a forest. It can be anywhere, but for me, it's forests. And it like people don't realize that, like, we've grown up in such a mess mechanistic culture that says, it's like scientific atheism, where the world is completely inanimate, and it just is a function of, of factors that we can control. And we assume that consciousness is, only humans are conscious, computers can be conscious, but we don't realize that the very fact of our existence is miraculous, and means that we don't actually really know what's going on. And in that, like, when you're in a forest, the trees talk to you. The forest literally talks to you if you listen. But the problem is, we're not listening. And I spend most of my time as an activist in front of a computer, so it's not like I'm an expert in this. But if you listen to to wildlife, if you listen to plants and animals, like, they are just as individual and just as real as we are. And they occupy the world in a different way, but that doesn't mean the way that they occupy the world is any less important than the way we occupy the world. It's just that we have an incredible power to destroy the world or not, whereas they aren't even in the position to make that decision and are simply a part of the world. And I think that's what we need to learn to do, is regain our position as being a part of the world, not lords and possessors of the world. And yeah, I mean, I think one of the most tragic things that I find, I go to a lot of timber sales, like hundreds, and I'll go into them and, you know, there'll just be a squirrel who's like on this tree. And I know that tree's going to get cut down in 6 months. And it's just really tragic. Just even like squirrels aren't endangered, but they are, they're part of a community. They're alive. They, you know, they have plans, they're storing for the winter. And it's, you know, to think that, you know, the winter isn't going to come for that squirrel is just, it's heartbreaking. And then you'll go back a few weeks later, a few months later, when the forest gets cut down, and you'll see wildlife, you'll see these little owls, you'll see birds, squirrels on the edge of the, like on the fringe where the forest was cut down. And they're sitting there and they are traumatized. They're just sitting there and they're acting very strangely. They're just, they don't know what to do and they don't have a home to go back to. So they're going to die. And we need to extend our circle of compassion to the non-human world just as much as we do to each other. And that doesn't necessarily mean that we don't kill. Like, you know, I eat carrots. I'm a vegan, but I like hunter-gatherers hunt animals. So it's, you know, it's not that we can't participate in the natural cycle of life and death in the natural world, you know, eating salmon, growing your own food, foraging. It's that we need to have our place in it and know our place in it, because right now, you know, we're destroying entire habitat so that we can have golf courses. We have the power of gods over the natural world, we don't have the wisdom of gods, essentially, is the issue. And we have the wisdom of like a toddler with a new toy, and we're destroying the world and not even realizing what we're destroying, and having the narcissism to assume that we are the only beings who matter and the only beings who feel and the only beings who think. And, you know, a lot of, you know, other animals, like, we don't know how they think. We don't know how they exist in this world. We know it's different to us. And for all we know, they know they're experiencing a whole different section of the universe than we are. And we need to respect that just because it's different doesn't mean that we're better than them.
Thank you so much for all that. That was great. And I think about this a lot in terms of everything, but like, for example, honeybees, it's a small example. Honeybees see infrared. I'm sorry, they see ultraviolet and they don't see infrared. The color spectrum that they see is shifted. And when you look at flowers, technologically, or we can use technology to look at flowers and see them the way they do. And flowers have look different to their vision. And they'll have like little arrows or little runways pointing them to where the nectar is. And I always think about how I've seen aphid infestations outside before, and the trees or the plants send off messages to call ladybug larvae and to call wasps and to call all sorts of other creatures to come eat the ladybugs, and how there is this just riot of intelligences out there and this mass communication that is, you know, that puts email and the internet, you know, that's the World Wide Web, but there's a real World Wide Web out there of mass communication going on that we don't, for the most part, perceive, and so we just pretend isn't there.
Yeah, it's something that we need to be plugging into again, and I think that's
And I want to mention
central issue.
Yeah, I agree, and I want to mention one more thing, which is, you know, you were talking about squirrels, and also, you know, and you and I are in complete agreement that non-humans are no. You know, it's not that non-humans are stupid and humans are smart. And I just want to point out that squirrels hide thousands of nuts every year. And they can remember where something like 50 or 70% are. And you're young, so you may still be different on this, but if I don't put my car keys in exactly the same place every day, I can't find them. And that's one thing. You know, I had one job is to remember where those car keys are, and they can remember where a half or two thirds of their stored thousands of nuts are. It's just absolutely insane. The insane is the wrong word. It's marvelous. Their capacities for they're just their capacities. That's all.
Yeah. I think of whales, which are able to communicate across the ocean, and it's like it's crazy. And I think that as humans, we're in a position where we can ignore what they're saying. And there's no doubt what they're saying. When you're in a forest that's about to be cut down, like, they're saying, don't let me get cut down. And whether you want to call that spiritual garbage, or whether you think that there's a way to explain it through science, or whether you think that's me just projecting, either way, the result is the same. We need to act to save these places. All of them. There is no halfway measure that will say, okay, we save half of the forests and, you know, the rest of the world can be destroyed. It's like, we need to create a world where destroying the world isn't the primary function of our society. And right now, that is the way our world is set up, and that's what needs to change. And how we do that is a whole different story. And I don't necessarily, even after, you know, after going through the journey of making the film, I don't necessarily think that there is an easy answer to that, but it's guaranteed not to happen if we don't try.
So let's go back to the film itself. Can you tell us more about both the making of the film and the film itself?
Yeah, so I started working on the film, started filming when I was 15 back in 2018. So it's been a 4-year long project, and I essentially was in high school and decided, you know, what is the point of, you know, getting a high school education if the world is literally, you know, on a, you know, has its days numbered in terms of, you know, with climate change and with the ecological crisis. So at that time, it was mostly focused around the IPCC report, and, you know, Trump was in office. It very much felt like nothing good was happening. So I'd heard about this mine called the Adani Carmichael coal mine, which essentially is the first mine in this area called the Galilee Basin, which is the largest, or was up until, you know, a few years ago, the largest untapped coal deposit in the world. And this mine would build a rail line to the Galilee coal basin in Australia. And that rail line would be able to service another, I think it's between like 9, 10, or 11 other coal mines that are proposed and going through approval processes in the Galilee coal basin. And I think people are under the conception that, oh, coal's on its way out, it's all good. But this past year, we burnt more coal than any other year in history, back in 2022. And I think 2023 is scheduled to beat that. That's primarily because of the war in Ukraine. But the fact is that the coal industry is not going anywhere. And the first part of the film is essentially us, you know, meeting with people who are trying to stop the mine, doing direct action, learning about the Great Barrier Reef, learning about this town called Ackland, where another coal company's essentially wiped a town off of the map. And it's sort of an introduction into, like, oh, you know, things are definitely going wrong. But it, you know, at the end of that section of the film is when I learned that basically after we went to Australia, and, you know, there were all these people fighting it, and people felt like it wasn't going to happen because, you know, we're moving on to a new era, and, you know, things are changing. It got approved. So on the heels of that, it was kind of like, oh, shoot, you know, what do we do? And I'd always, like, the film goes to multiple different areas. You know, we go to the Tongass, we go. But the film is essentially grappling with the fact that not only are we losing, but we've lost. You know, we've lost, you know, all of the passenger pigeons. We've lost most of our old growth forests. We've lost, you know, we're already dealing with climate change, like that you know 20 years ago we would never predicted would be happening right now. And that's one of the things that a number of the scientists that we talked to said, is essentially that they didn't realize how fast it would happen, and it's happening really fast. And it also, we also look into sort of the co-optation of NGOs, where the NGO model of saving the planet has essentially been to make deals where it's like, you log one forest, we'll save another. But that entire model is what's got us into this predicament to begin with. And I think when I was making the film, I felt like none of the climate change documentaries ever really expressed the emotions necessary to when you're losing life on Earth, or when you're not, we're not losing all of it, but we're losing a lot of it, like a very substantial amount of it. And actually going through the stages of grief and really feeling what that ultimately means is hard. And it's definitely not an easy film to watch at some points, but it's necessary to go through that that reckoning, because if you don't go through that reckoning, and if you just say, oh well, you know, things could get really bad, but let's look elsewhere and not keep going down that road, because its implications are pretty dire. If civilization itself is unsustainable, then what's going to happen to everybody on the planet when civilization collapses? Like, you know, that's not a happy thought. But you know, instead of thinking that thought and thinking about its implications and figuring out what to do, the environmental movement has said, oh no, it's okay, we're going to do renewables and then it'll all be better. And then just kind of gloss over everything that says that it won't be better. And that renewables themselves, I was actually at COP15 recently, the biodiversity conference in Montreal. And right there, the Minister of Natural Resources for Canada was saying that, was on a panel, and somebody else was saying that we need to realize that a more green, more healthy future means more mining, not less. And that's exactly it, is the environmental movement, because they haven't really looked into the void and seen where the real issue lies and what we're really facing, has kind of skipped a step and moved on to technological solutions for the environmental crisis. And what the film does is kind of, we go through that process and we come out the other side, and it's like, okay, if the world really is doomed, and they're like, we don't necessarily know what we can do to save it, but we know that we know what we shouldn't be doing, and we know that we should be saving every bit of the planet that we can, whether or not it's possible to, you know, dismantle civilization and have everybody kind of create a better future together. Like, I don't know that that's possible, but if we don't start trying, and we don't start trying to protect every single area that's at risk of destruction, then we're kind of signing our own death warrant. And, you know, one of the things that I found really hard, and I do find really hard to this day in environmentalism, is, you know, most of the time when you're trying to stop a timber sale, you lose. And that's hard, because it's like, it can really hurt, and it can send you into depression, and it's really hard when you're seeing areas like old growth forests, for instance, up in BC, that, you know, I was in 1 month and the trees are literally, you know, 8, 9, 10 feet thick and 1,000 years old. And then a week later, they're gone. And it's just like, it's gut wrenching. So part of what we'd examined in the documentary was how do we actually act in a way that will work? And this Roger Hallam, who's the founder of Extinction Rebellion, one of the things he said in the film was, you know, it's not about what future you envision. It's not about, you know, what is your, you know, what's the aspiration. It's about does it mean to be human right now? Like, what does a human who's confronted with this do as somebody who can, you know, as somebody who will be looked back on by future generations? What can you do in this moment as your own autonomous person now to what's the right thing to do? And the answer to that is, the right thing to do is to fight, and to fight for every place that you can fight for, and to do everything you possibly can that's in your power to try to slow the ecocide of the natural world and mitigate climate change. And whether or not you succeed isn't the point, because if that's the measure that you use to judge your actions, then you're not going to succeed probably, you know, 3/4 of the time. But in a quarter of the time, you will succeed. And if you come at it from a point of view of I'm going to do whatever I can as a person now to save the planet, and I'll judge myself by my actions, not the results, then you actually have you're able to continue saving places without having the grief destroy you. So that's one of the things that I really took away. And to not be a bystander is the biggest point. So yeah, the film took 4 years to make. It was pretty much entirely edited by me. My dad and my uncle helped shoot the film a bit, and it was really like almost no budget. We were just kind of driving around, sleeping in the car. I went up to Alaska when I was 16. I was up there interviewing people by myself in like just very rural Alaska. So it was quite the experience. But yeah, I think it has a message that needs to be heard, and it's what I came to after, you know, facing, I guess, the void of our future. And yeah, I think that it doesn't include everything, but it's essentially what I learned as a teenager trying to figure out how to save the planet.
That's all really great stuff. And it makes me think a few things. One of them is a lot of things, actually. One of them is that you keep talking about the environmental movement, and I agree with you, and I've said the same language. I'm not criticizing you at all. You know, in Bright Green Lies, we talk about how the environmental movement has lost its way, but whatever word you want to use. Have you noticed in your experience any sort of distinction between sort of grassroots environmental activists and more mainstream activists in terms of, well, I'll just say my experience. My experience, a lot of grassroots activists really are biocentric, and the mainstream activists really are trying to maintain civilization. And I have always seen a pretty big split. Of course, there are some grassroots environmentalists who are still, you know, not what I think you and I would call deep ecologists, but a lot of grassroots environmentalists are specifically doing it for wild nature. And this is a real question. Is your experience the same as mine on that, or did you perceive a lot of grassroots activists as doing this more for human-centric terms?
I think a lot of people haven't thought about it. I think a lot of people, I think a lot of people across the board want to do it to have a better future, but what I would say is I don't think that there's, you know, that it's particularly malicious. I think that people want to save the planet and they want to do what they can to help, but they're channeled into something that is seen as the solution and really isn't. And I don't think that that's because they're bad or because they don't want to save the living world. I think it's because they haven't been challenged and asked these questions. And the modern environmental movement fails to challenge people. It tends to have the sort of lowest common denominator, you know, let's all, you know, do things we can all agree on. And many, many both grassroots environmentalists and I think even, you know, environmentalists working for NGOs haven't been confronted with the reality that civilization itself is what's destroying the world. So I tend to think that most of even mainstream environmentalists, I tend to think that we agree on a lot, and the issue isn't any form of being malicious. I think it's a lack of awareness and education, because the sort of biocentric idea isn't very, people don't really fundamentally know what that means. And you'll hear people who agree with it, but are still like, you know, wanting to expand, you know, build more electric cars and stuff. So I tend to think that we should be trying to assume the best of people and assume that they would agree and would try to fight for the same things we're fighting for.
Right. I think. I wasn't suggesting maliciousness. This is what you're saying is very interesting to me. And I think this might be in Bright Green Lies, we talk about how the environmental movement has lost its way, and how at one point it was about saving wild places and wild beings, and now it's become more about saving civilization. And the
yeah, I'd
reason
agree with that. Yeah.
The reason that I brought this up is because I have a lot more experience. I had a lot more experience with a lot of grassroots activists in the 90s than I do now. And from what you're saying, I'll just be straight up that the activists I knew in the 90s, for the most part, they were forest defenders. The activists I knew in the 90s, for the most part, they were almost all, holding on by their fingernails, basically trying to protect this or that piece of ground until civilization collapsed. They all were praying for civilization to collapse, and because that's the only way in the long term the area is going to be protected. And they were all doing it for the spotted owls, for the bull trout, for the Selkirk caribou. And my point is, I am not as conversant with modern day forest defenders. And so it sounds to me like that shift, which I think is top down away from biocentrism, it sounds like that shift has permeated it a bit more than I would have hoped. Is this making sense? Do you see what I'm trying to get at?
Yeah, no, I know what you're saying. I think that, yeah, I don't think that, I think that a lot of people have been sold on the idea that we're going to reform civilization, including grassroots people. And I think it's absolutely true that they all have their hearts in the right place. And
I was not saying that.
I'm not saying that. Yeah. But I think that a lot of people have been sold on the notion that we can have a sustainable industrial civilization. Like the efforts around renewable energy for the past 20 years have kind of sold people the idea that that people are in it for, you know, saving the wildlife. Like a lot of people are in it for that. A lot of people aren't, but a lot of people are. But they've been sold the idea, I think, not everybody, but many people, that we're going to save the forest and we're going to have a greener civilization and, you know, we can have our cake and eat it too, in a way. And I think there's less acknowledgement that industrial civilization itself is what's blatantly evil. Like there's this idea that we can have a techno-utopia that also saves the planet. And I hope that the film kind of helps debunk that idea. But in terms of the common discourse, I think a lot of people take civilization as a granted and think in general that it's a good thing. And that's definitely based off of a lack of education around the impacts of civilization. But, you know, it's like, you know, you'll have people who are fighting for indigenous rights and want to decolonize, which I absolutely agree with. I absolutely support. But in the context of civilization, so it's almost like we can have a non-colonial civilization. It's like, well, I don't think you understand how civilization works. because the civilization, even if you're not colonizing indigenous land, you're colonizing, you're still destroying forests. You're still using the land in a colonized relationship where you literally have colonies, for instance, of tree plantations, or you have corn colonies to get your food. Like that's still colonization. And I think that a lot of people could sort of see the systemic issues with civilization, but that discourse is very uncommon now. And I do think that most people haven't heard of it, and I think that's a pity, and that's why we want to get as many people to see this film as possible, because it takes you from I think where a lot of people are and where I was a few years ago to a more radical viewpoint.
Well, we have about 5 minutes left, and can you tell people how they can see your film, how they can learn more about your work, and also what fabulous film you're planning on working on next?
Yeah, so the film is called Eden's Last Chance, and it came out on April 18th in time for Earth Day. So it's out right now on, it's on Amazon, it's on Vudu, It's on Tubi and a number of others, a number of other spots, but you can go to the website, edenslastchance.com, and there's a URL that'll direct you to places where you can watch it. There's the trailer up there. And if you want to follow me, I'm at Joshua Wright Film on Instagram. I also have a website called Universal Wildlands, and I post pictures essentially from all the timber sales I go to up there, just, you know, so people can see what's being lost. And in terms of films,
can you go back through those again? Just give the URLs again slowly so like people can write them down.
Yeah, so
the three URLs.
Yes. Okay, so the film, you can find the film, and you can find like where to watch it and the trailer and stuff at edenslastchance.com. And then you can follow me at Joshua Wright Film on Instagram. And yeah, the film should be on Amazon, Vudu, and a number of other streaming sites. And yeah, to get it, you just have to go to edenslastchance.com.
With no apostrophe.
No apostrophe.
And the photographs are at universalwildlands.com, correct?
Yeah, and that's where I post pictures from essentially all of the places I go to that are going to get cut down. So there's a lot of timber, like legacy forests from Washington State, and there's a lot of old growth forests that have been or are set to be cut down. And yeah, just trying to spread awareness around that.
Great. And okay, so now, sorry to interrupt. Go ahead. Your new work.
Yeah, so Eden's Last Chance for me was kind of, before I made it, I really felt like I had something I wanted to say. And I think I've said it. And I'm not saying I won't make any new films in the future, but while I was making Eden's Last Chance, I felt like I was watching other people save the planet, and I really wanted to save forests and do that. So that's what I'm doing right now. I'm working as much as I can to try to save old growth forests in British Columbia, as well as legacy forests, which are forests that naturally regenerated from logging in the, you know, 1800s and early 1900s. We're trying to save those in Washington State. And then I'm also working on trying to protect land in Northern California. There's a old growth forest that I'm trying to find people to protect down there. So yeah, I think right now my goals are to sort of focus on saving forests, but also try to create an activism community that is actually starting to figure out how we can live apart from industrial civilization. Because I think that's a key thing that is often missed, is the fact that, you know, there's one part of activism where you're just defending, you know, the natural world as much as you can, but that's not going to be sustainable in the long term unless we also have communities that are trying to live within the natural world and trying to forage and, you know, trying to actually have communities that maybe resemble non-industrial communities. Because right now, as an activist, I spend almost all my time wired to a computer, and part of the revolution needs to be actually creating communities that are as autonomous as possible from the civilization that's killing the planet. And that's something I really want to start working on. So that's probably my, you know, 5-year goal.
So what advice would you have for, and if it's same advice, that's fine. If it's different advice, that's fine too. What advice is the last question? What advice would you have for a 15-year-old or a 25-year-old or a 35-year-old who is where you were at the start of this whole path? What advice would you give them?
Well, I think that if you start looking around, and if you're listening to this, you probably already have, you'll see areas around you, whether it's a development, whether it's a fossil fuel project, whether it's a forest getting cut down. Like, you just have to look to see areas being destroyed. And when you're doing the looking, you suddenly become, in a way, responsible for stopping it. At least that's my experience. And I guess I would say, don't be a bystander in the death of the living world. And if not you, then who? If not now, then when? That's my message. Like, we don't, you won't regret trying to do everything you can to save what's left of the living world. And that's, for myself personally, like, that's the legacy I want to leave, is maybe a few more forests, maybe, you know, a species that isn't quite so endangered. And I think that's all that we can do. So I'd say fight like hell.
Well, thank you so much for that. And thank you for your work in the world. Thank you for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Joshua Wright. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.